Hello, and let's resume our study of the life divine. Tonight we're continuing in chapter 22, Rebirth in Other Worlds, Karma, the Soul, and Immortality. Prefaced with citations from the Taittiriya Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Shvetashvatara Upanishad. We have this evening and next evening in which to finish this section of the Life Divine, this particular chapter. And then we'll move on to the final six chapters. Sri Aurobindo has been poking holes to this point in the common view of the law of karma and what it signifies for the developing soul living its lives out upon earth. So we'll pick it up here in the middle of it, and I think it'll still make sense. He says, there is indeed in our life a very large element of what we call luck or fortune, which balks our effort of result or gives the prize without effort or to an inferior energy. The secret cause of these caprices of destiny or causes for the roots of fortune may be manifold, must be no doubt partly sought for in our hidden past. But it is difficult to accept the simple solution that good luck is a return for a forgotten virtuous action in a past life, and bad luck a return for a sin or crime. Remembering the context that if we do a certain kind of good action or a certain kind of bad action, shouldn't we reap that in terms of our fortune upon earth? If we've been good in the past, shouldn't we be rich in this life? If we've been bad in the past, shouldn't we be poor in this life? Shouldn't we rejoice or suffer accordingly? Sri Aurobindo's response is that's far too simple a perspective, and there are many lines, many elements of natural law that come together in the focus that we call an individual life. If we see the righteous man suffering here, it is difficult to believe that this paragon of virtue was in the last life a scoundrel and is paying, even after his exemplary conversion by a new birth, for sins he then committed. Nor, if the wicked triumphs, can we easily suppose that he was in his last life a saint who has suddenly taken a wrong turn, but continues to receive a cash return for his previous crime, for his previous virtue, pardon me. A total change of this kind between life and life is possible, though not likely to be frequent. But to saddle the new opposite personality with the rewards or punishments of the old looks like a purposeless and purely mechanical procedure. This and many other difficulties arise, and the too simple logic of the correlation is not so strong as it claims to be. The idea of retribution of karma as a compensation for the injustice of life and nature is a feeble basis for the theory, for it puts forward a shallow and superficial human feeling and standard as the sense of the cosmic law, and is based on an unsound reasoning. There must be some other and stronger foundation for the law of karma. Here, as so often, the error comes by our forcing a standard, which is the creation of our human mind, into the larger, freer, and more comprehensive ways of the cosmic intelligence. in the action attributed to the law of karma, two values are selected out of the many created by nature: moral good and evil, sin and virtue, and vital physical good and evil, outward happiness and suffering, outward good fortune and ill fortune. And it is supposed that there must be an equation between them. The one must be the reward or the punishment of the other, the final sanction which it receives in the secret justice of nature. This collocation means placed together. This collocation is evidently made from the viewpoint of a common vital physical desire in our members, because happiness and good fortune are what the lower part of our vital mean most desires, misfortune and suffering what it most hates and dreads. It proceeds when it accepts the moral demand upon it for the curbing of its propensities, for the self-restraint from doing evil and self-exertion towards doing what is good, to strike a bargain, to erect a cosmic law which will compensate it for this strenuous self-compulsion and help it, by the dread of punishment, to adhere to its difficult path of self-denial. So this is the argument to entice the vital to behave so that it gets the things that satisfy its appetites. But the truly ethical being does not need a system of rewards and punishments to follow the path of good and shun the path of evil. Virtue to him is its own reward. Sin brings with it its own punishment in the suffering of a fall from his own law of nature. This is the true ethical standard. And this is Greek philosophy, carried forward into the whole of Western thinking and theology. On the contrary, a system of rewards and punishments debases at once the ethical values of good, turns virtue into selfishness, a commercial bargain of self-interest, and replaces the right motive of abstinence from evil by a baser motive. The baser motive being, I'll do good because then I get this reward. That's not as good as simply doing good because it's your nature to do it or because it calls to you from your higher nature. Human beings have erected the rule of reward and punishment as a social necessity in order to restrain the doing of things harmful to the community and encourage what is helpful to it. But to erect this human device into a general law of cosmic nature, or a law of the supreme being, or the supreme law of existence, is a procedure of doubtful value. It is human, but also puerile, childish, to impose the insufficient and narrow standards of our own ignorance on the larger and more intricate operations of cosmic nature, or on the action of the supreme wisdom and supreme good, which draws or raises us towards itself by a spiritual power working slowly in ourselves through our inner being, and not by a law of temptation and compulsion upon our outer vital nature. If the soul is passing through an evolution by a many-sided and complex experience, any law of karma or return to action and output of energy, if it is to fit itself into that experience, must also be complex and cannot be of a simple and exiguous texture or rigid and one-sided in its incidence. So, karma must itself be supple and many-sided. Exiguous, by the way, means slender or scanty. At the same time, a partial truth of fact, not of fundamental or general principle, may be admitted for this doctrine, for although the lines of the action of energy are distinct and independent, they can act together and upon each other, though not by any rigidly fixed law of correspondence. It is possible that in the total method of the returns of nature, there intervenes a strand of connection, or rather of interaction, between vital physical good and ill, and ethical good and ill, a limited correspondence and meeting point between divergent dualities not amounting to an inseparable coherence. So, in other words, there can be a belt of behavior in which these things come together, where you do get the response from nature that the common mentality of humanity would regard as a right return. He continues, our own varying energies, desires, movements are mixed together in their working and can bring about a mixed result. Our vital part does demand substantial and external rewards for virtue, for knowledge, for every intellectual, aesthetic, moral, or physical effort. It believes firmly in punishment for sin and even for ignorance. Thank goodness the vital cannot forever be the judge. If we accept the action of invisible forces upon us, there may be also invisible forces in life nature that belong to the same plane of consciousness force as this part of our being, forces that move according to the same plan or the same power motive as our lower vital nature. It can be often observed that when a self-assertive vital egoism goes on trampling on its way without restraint or scruple all that opposes its will or desire, it raises a mass of reactions against itself, reactions of hatred, antagonism, unease in men, which may have their result now or hereafter, and still more formidable adverse reactions in universal nature. It is as if the patience of nature, her willingness to be used, were exhausted. The very forces that the ego of the strong vital man seized and bent to its purpose rebel and turn against him. Those he had trampled on rise up and receive power for his downfall. The insolent vital force of man strikes against the throne of necessity and is dashed to pieces, or the lame foot of punishment reaches at last the successful offender. So these outrageous vital extravagances do call upon themselves the recompense they in fact demand. Nature gets bored of that kind of misuse of its energies and brings to them what they ordered from the menu. It may be within the vision of the moment now, or it may be in the longer run of things, but it will come. This reaction to his energies may come upon him in another life and not at once. It may be a burden of consequence he takes up in his return to the field of these forces. It may happen on a small as well as a large scale to the small vital being and his small errors, as well as in these larger instances. For the principle will be the same. The mental being in us, seeking for success by a misuse of force, which nature admits but reacts in the end against it, receives the adverse return in the guise of defeat and suffering and failure. But the promotion of this minor line of causes and results to the status of an invariable absolute law or the whole cosmic rule of action of a supreme being is not valid. They belong to a middle region between the inmost or supreme truth of things and the impartiality of material nature. And here he's talking about, again, this vital impulse and the mental judgment of whether these things are successes, failures, etc. These are not the sources towards which we look for the answers of why karma is the machinery we need in nature. What is its real utility? What is its real purpose? So, in any case, the reactions of nature are not, in essence, meant as reward or punishment. That is not their fundamental value, which is rather an inherent value of natural relations, and insofar as it affects the spiritual evolution, a value of the lessons of experience in the soul's cosmic training. So it isn't that nature is trying to reward or punish. It's giving you the response that nature offers when you execute an action at a certain level. It shows you what the response is from nature at that level. And it can be a teaching that nature gives you in what you will get in your soul's training here in the world. If we touch fire, it burns. But there is no principle of punishment in this relation of cause and effect. It is a lesson of relation and a lesson of experience. So, in all nature's dealings with us, there is a relation of things, and there is a corresponding lesson of experience. We do this, we get that, and we learn. The action of the cosmic energy is complex, and the same forces may act in different ways according to circumstances, to the need of the being, to the intention of the cosmic power in its action. Our life is affected not only by its own energies, but by the energies of others and by universal forces. And all this vast interplay cannot be determined in its results solely by the one factor of an all-governing moral law and its exclusive attention to the merits and demerits, the sins and virtues of individual human beings. There's a bigger game at play. There is a cosmic play. And we tiny individuals are not the absolute focus of everything. Nor can good fortune and evil fortune, pleasure and pain, happiness and misery and suffering be taken as if they existed merely as incentives and deterrents to the natural being in its choice of good and evil. It is for experience, for growth of the individual being, that the soul enters into rebirth. Joy and grief, pain and suffering, fortune and misfortune are parts of that experience, means of that growth. Even the soul may of itself accept or choose poverty, misfortune, and suffering as helpful to its growth, stimulants of a rapid development, and reject riches and prosperity and success as dangerous and conducive to a relaxation of its spiritual effort. Happiness and success, bringing happiness, are no doubt a legitimate demand of humanity. It is an attempt of life and matter to catch a pale reflection or a gross image of felicity. but a superficial happiness and material success, however desirable to our vital nature, are not the main object of our existence. If that had been the intention, life would have been otherwise arranged in the cosmic ordinance of things. So yes, happiness, because always we're looking for ananda and felicity, French félicité from the Latin félix, means happiness and delight. That is the thing. But what is it that prompts our growth? And must we have immediate happiness or delight? Can it not be postponed? Can we not search for the real thing and leave the apparent? Look for the good and not merely for the pleasant, as the Upanishad suggests. All the secret of the circumstances of rebirth, he writes, centers around the one capital need of the soul, the need of growth, the need of experience. That governs the line of its evolution, and all the rest is accessory. Remember in our last reading, Sri Aurobindo, again, recalled to us that the soul comes here for experience. It leaves the oneness of the supreme nature to come into division, to look through divisibility for the force of reunification, to bring to consummation all the oneness that lies secret at the basis of the cosmos and is no longer apparent. So its goal is tremendous. And again, it is experience. It calls it here, but it is an experience that delivers the greater knowledge. It isn't the knowledge totaled up by mentation that stands as gnosis. It is the experience of oneness in the soul that is the real knowledge that expresses itself through the instruments of nature. Cosmic existence is not a vast administrative system of universal justice with a cosmic law of recompense and retribution as its machinery, or a divine legislator and judge at its center. It is seen by us first as a great automatic movement of energy of nature, Shakti. And in it emerges a self-developing movement of consciousness, a movement, therefore, of spirit, working out its own being in the motion of energy of nature, Chit Shakti. In this motion takes place the cycle of rebirth, and in that cycle, the soul, the psychic being, prepares for itself, or the divine wisdom or the cosmic consciousness force prepares for it and through its action, whatever is needed for the next step in its evolution, the next formation of personality, the coming nexus of necessary experiences, constantly provided and organized out of the continuous flux of past, present, and future energies for each new birth, for each new step of the spirit, backward or forward, or else still in a circle, but always a step in the growth of the being towards its destined self-unfolding in nature. This is a key idea in Sri Aurobindo's thinking. The soul is in a deep conspiracy with the Supreme, and its purpose is growth back towards that origin, but based here in the determinations of nature in this world that we have before us. And whether we're going forward or backwards, or turning in circles, it is always for a purpose that is consonant with the spirit's demand and nature. We have the idea that each birth must be tracing a linear progress upward. We're starting here in ignorance and we're going straight up. But sometimes we spiral. Sometimes we turn. Sometimes we've forgotten something and have to go back to collect it. Sometimes we simply pause. Other times we march forward vigorously for an ultimate conquest. All of it attuned to the Spirit's demand and registered here in this life in the way that must be for us. So we should have confidence in our soul and in the deep commerce that it has with the divine. This brings us to another element of the ordinary conception of rebirth, which is not acceptable, since it is an obvious error of the physical mind. The idea of the soul itself as a limited personality which survives unchanged from one birth to another. This is not so, he says. This too simple and superficial idea of the soul and personality is born of the physical mind's inability to look beyond its own apparent self-formation in this single existence. We're attached to the self that we know, and so we project it into the future. In its conception, what returns in the reincarnation must be not only the same spiritual being, the same psychic entity, but the same formation of nature that inhabited the body of the last birth. The body changes, the circumstances are different, but the form of the being, the mind, the character, the disposition, temperament, tendencies are the same. John Smith in his new life is the same John Smith that he was in his last avatar. But if that were so, there would be no spiritual utility or meaning at all in rebirth. For there would be the repetition of the same little personality, the same small mental and vital formation to the end of time. For the growth of the embodied being towards the full stature of its reality, not only a new experience, but a new personality is indispensable. To repeat the same personality would only be helpful if something had been incomplete in its formation of its experience, which needed to be worked out in the same cadre of self, in the same building of mind, and with the same formed capacity of energy. But normally, this would be quite otios. Otios, from the Latin otium, leisure, it means unoccupied, indolent, just hanging around. But normally, this would be quite otios. The soul that has been John Smith cannot gain anything or fulfill itself by remaining John Smith forever. It cannot achieve growth or perfection by repeating the same character, interests, occupations, types of inner and outer movements forever. Our life and rebirth would be always the same recurring decimal. It would be not an evolution, but the meaningless continuity of an eternal repetition. Our attachment to our present personality demands such a continuity, such a repetition. John Smith wants to be John Smith forever, but the demand is obviously ignorant, and if it were satisfied, that would be a frustration, not a fulfillment. It is only by a change of outer self, a constant progression of the nature, a growth in the spirit, that we can justify our existence. There are schools of philosophy which regard the eternal recurrence, the endless rebirth of the individual in such a way that it's rather mechanical. That just as you were born last time, you will be born this time, and the mistakes that you made last time will be made this time, and on and on and on it goes. What a frustrating universe that would be. Sri Aurobindo's view really cuts through all of these philosophies, whether they're Eastern or Western, and offers something that, again, is resolved in the largest spiritual experience, his own. He continues, personality is only a temporary mental, vital, physical formation which the being, the real person, the psychic entity, puts forward on the surface. It is not the self in its abiding reality. So let's pause for a moment and say, thus far, the Buddha is correct in saying there is no self. Because if what we ignorantly identify as ourself is this floating personality on the front of our being, based on a body, enlivened with vitality, somewhat cognizant with a mind that flits and comes and goes, and that personality is constituted by the interaction of these three elements, then indeed, that is temporary. That is not real. That is a fictional or a transient self. So Buddha, in saying anatta, not soul, is correct so far as it goes. But Sri Aurobindo asserts that there is a real being behind which projects itself forward through the personality into ingrained nature, to have this experience of the world. And he continues. Let me just read that whole section again. Personality is only a temporary mental, vital, physical formation which the being, the real person, the psychic entity, puts forward on the surface. It is not the self in its abiding reality. In each return to earth, the person, the Purusha, makes a new formation, builds a new personal quantum suitable for a new experience, for a new growth of its being. When it passes from its body, it keeps still the same vital and mental form for a time. But the forms or sheaths dissolve, and what is kept is only the essential elements of the past quantum, of which some will, but some may not be used in the next incarnation. So, a physical being, anamaya purusha, a vital being, pranamaya purusha, a mental being, manomaya purusha. Each of these, in a sense, is a temporary house of the person, but is not the real person. The deeper person, the conscious person, chaitu purusha, is behind, and these are projections on the surface. Eventually, they dissolve. He doesn't go into the larger argument about that at this moment, but they go away. But the essential elements may be kept for the next incarnation. And now he continues. The essential form of the past personality may remain as one element among many, one personality among many personalities of the same person. But in the background, in the subliminal behind the veil of the surface mind and life and body, contributing from there whatever is needed of itself to the new formation. But it will not itself be the whole formation or build anew the old, unchanged type of nature. So, these kinds of essential personality that remain behind in this treasury, you might say, can make contributions to the next incarnation or to the current incarnation. But they will not suffice as a mere reiteration of what has already been lived. The conscious person, the Purusha, wants to build something new and may draw upon the richness of stored in these personalities for something that it needs to express or further explore in this incarnation. It may even be that the new quantum or structure of being will exhibit a quite contrary character and temperament, quite other capacities, other very different tendencies, for latent potentials may be ready to emerge, or something already in action but inchoate may have been held back in the last life which needed to be worked out, but was kept over for a later and more suitable combination of the possibilities of the nature. Inchoate, only begun. So something may have been nearing the point where it could be expressed, but it wasn't quite ready in the last life, and it waited to this point in the subsequent incarnation for it to come to full flower and say, here I am, this is what I want to do. All the past is indeed there, but with its accelerated impetus and potentialities for the formation of the future, but all of it is not ostensibly present and active. So in this treasury, all these personalities are ready and waiting, but they're not obvious. They're not clear on the front. The greater the variety of formations that have existed in the past and can be utilized, the more rich and multitudinous the accumulated buildings of experience, the more their essential result of capacity for knowledge, power, action, character, manifold response to the universe can be brought forward and harmonized in the new birth. The more numerous the veiled personalities, mental, vital, subtle, physical, that combine to enrich the new personality on the surface, the greater and more opulent will be that personality, and the nearer to the possible transition out of the completed mental stage of evolution to something beyond it. Such a complexity and gathering up of many personalities in one person can be a sign of a very advanced stage of the individual's evolution when there is a strong central being that holds all together and works towards harmonization and integration of the whole many-sided movement of the nature. But this opulent taking up of the past would not be a repetition of personality. It would be a new formation and large consummation. It is not as a machinery for the persistent renewal or prolongation of an unchanging personality that rebirth exists, but as a means for the evolution of the spiritual being in nature. Another summary statement. So, the richer the personality, the more extensive its experience in nature, the more the bewildering display of personalities available in such a one. And you think about great beings who are like this, who are many-sided, like the mother. No two photographs are the same. Every moment she exhibited a different goddess power, And she could be light and frivolous when she wanted. She could be serene. She could be sober. She could be thunderous in using her energy to shatter some poor, lingering, reluctant formation. She could be anything she needed to be at the moment, because she was all that. Krishna, not known for one mood, but every possible kind of mood. And there were great personalities in the early years of the ashram, too, who exhibited so much that each inning revealed some new depth, some new splendor from their being. And I won't embarrass any of those present with what a treasury they themselves are. I think this is a good place to put a bookmark, and I think I would like to choose a passage from Savitri, which describes the mother that many of us knew in the ashram. This comes in Book 4, The Book of Birth and Quest, in Canto 3, The Call to the Quest. This is just after Ashwapati's audience of a great voice from above. The voice withdrew into its hidden skies, but like a shining answer from the gods, approached through sun-bright spaces Savitri. Advancing amid tall heaven-pillaring trees, apparelled in her flickering colored robe, she seemed, burning towards the eternal realms, a bright, moved torch of incense and of flame, that from the sky-roofed temple soil of earth, a pilgrim hand lifts in an invisible shrine. There came the gift of a revealing hour. He saw through depths that reinterpret all, limited not now by the dull body's eyes, new found through an arch of clear discovery, this intimation of the world's delight, this wonder of the divine artist's make, carved like a nectar cup for thirsty gods, this breathing scripture of the eternal's joy, this net of sweetness woven of aureate fire. Transformed, the delicate image face became a deeper nature's self-revealing sign, a gold leaf palimpsest of sacred births, a grave world symbol chiseled out of life. Her brow, a copy of clear, unstained heavens, was meditation's pedestal and defense, the very room and smile of musing space, its brooding line, infinity's symbol curve. Amid her dresses' cloudy multitude, her long eyes shadowed as by wings of night, under that moon-gold forehead's dreaming breath, were seas of love and thought that held the world. Marveling at life and earth, they saw truths far. A deathless meaning filled her mortal limbs. As in a golden vase's poignant line, they seemed to carry the rhythmic sob of bliss, of earth's mute adoration towards heaven, released in beauty's cry of living form towards the perfection of eternal things. Transparent grown, the ephemeral living dress bared the expressive deity to its view. escaped from surface sight and mortal sense. The seizing harmony of its shapes became the strange, significant icon of a power, renewing its inscrutable descent into a human figure of its works that stood out in life's bold, abrupt relief on the soil of the evolving universe. A godhead sculptured on a wall of thought, mirrored in the flowing hours and dimly shrined in matter as in a cathedral cave. Annulled were the transient values of the mind. The body's sense renounced its earthly look. Immortal met immortal in their gaze. Awaked from the close spell of daily use that hides soul truth with the outward form's disguise, he saw through the familiar cherished limbs the great and unknown spirit born his child. An impromptu from the deeper sight within, thoughts rose in him that knew not their own scope. Then to those large and brooding depths whence love regarded him across the straits of mind, he spoke in sentences from the unseen height. And I leave those lines for you to read. We'll continue in the Life Divine and in Savitri next week. Much love to you all. Thank you for being with us. Namaste, all our dear friends.